Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. We finally got some rain yesterday, and I am so thankful for that. With all the gardens and property I have here without any underground sprinklers, I am a walking, moving sprinkler system. And so the rain was so appreciated last night. Thank you, Universe, for providing that. Anyway, you're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. So happy to be here with all of you. I have a great show planned for you. I have two guests that will be joining me today, Stephanie Morningstar and Christine Hutchison. Stephanie is the coordinator of the Northeast Farmers of Color Land Trust, and Christine is a board member from there. But they both wear many hats and do so many different things. But I'm really excited to have them on to talk about the work of the Northeast Farmers of Color Land Trust, and to tell you some of the other wonderful things that they're involved in. And but of course, before they come on, I want to share with you some things going on in the news. Of course, we all know what those things are, and also ways you can take action and to share my weekly recipe. So I first wanted to share with any of you that are in a position of spreading the word, there is a special pandemic EBT program available for children during the summertime while school is out. And that is certainly needed for the electronic benefits transfer program, which is also known as SNAP, the supplemental program. This is extra money that families who are eligible can receive during the summer to keep food flowing in their homes. And it's really, really important. So many young people depend on the school lunch program, and a lot of schools are not prepared to keep providing that lunch during the summer. I know the school that I work at, Glen Cove Public School, has chosen not to continue feeding the kids in the summer because they would then have to keep the school building open and security, and they just don't have the funds for that. So this pandemic EBT program is now an extension of the regular program and gives extra money to families that have kids. So on my website, I have information about that, and I'd love everyone who is in the position of sharing that information to share it with anyone that might be in need. Also, great news is Monsanto, or Bayer, lost their lawsuits, and they settled at $10.9 billion. And those are lawsuits against Roundup. Bayer inherited these lawsuits when they acquired Monsanto. And they settled for $10.9 billion, but there are still lots of more lawsuits pending. And the exposure to glyphosate, which is an herbicide that is in Roundup, causes cancer. And there are so many other herbicides and pesticides that are also causing cancer that we are trying to get off the market. The fact that they are settling and yet still producing Roundup and putting it out there, and that people are still buying it and using it, just flabbergasts me. I can't get my mind around it and understand why. But, you know, anytime you see any opportunity to sign a petition or to let your voice be heard that you'd like Roundup off the market, please put it out there. I also want to share with you, I recently found out that Home Depot is a big supporter of Trump, where Lowe's is a big supporter of the Black Lives Matter movement. So if you're making a choice as to where to get your hardware, and you don't have a mom-and-pop shop around, which I would support first because we all need to support our local mom-and-pop shops, definitely boycott Home Depot and put your money into Lowe's. And then also this week, the Supreme Court, thank you to Chief Justice Roberts, voted for the liberal side of the Supreme Court and voted to voted that the Louisiana law restricting abortion was unconstitutional. And that is really big. And thank God, you know, I just thought Roe versus Wade was settled back in 1972, I think it was, and that was going to be the end of it. Little did I expect that, you know, 40 years later, we'd or 50 years later, we'd still be debating this issue. Whether you believe in abortion or not, that's a personal choice. And that's the issue here, that women should have a personal choice over their own bodies. And we need to really, really support that. So that was really great news, and the ramifications of that will be felt by many, many women. So thank you, Chief Justice Roberts, for voting the right way. And I also want to I have a great article that I shared on my website in Forbes magazine about healthy soil equals healthy food. And so often that is a discussion that I am a part of, and many people believe hydroponics is the way of the future. And I just want to put out there once again my belief that building up soil and healthy soil is not only better for our health and the food that we eat, but it's better for the environment. It helps to sequester carbon from the atmosphere and put it back into the soil where it belongs. And it is building up our topsoil. Right now, we have used up most of our topsoil. We only have enough topsoil for maybe another 60 years on the planet, unless we really start regenerating it and building it back up. And that's what organic farmers do. So organic farmers not only put out beautiful organic food, but they are also building up our soil so that we have a future, because our food comes from the soil. And the toxins that are constantly being sprayed through traditional industrial agriculture is just horrible for the planet. It's horrible for the environment. It's horrible for our health, and we really need to turn it around. And there's so much information out there showing how regenerative agriculture is the way of the future, and we need to let our voices be heard. So again, anytime you have an opportunity to sign a petition, to write to your congresspeople, to show up and vote, please. It is so important. Time is of the essence, and our future generations will not have food if we don't do this. So there's also ways that you can take action. You know, the Black Lives Matter movement has really gaining momentum, thank God. We really need to all join forces together to end the systemic racism that our country has been based on. We have never apologized. We've never said we're sorry to the Native populations that are here. We have, you know, one thing, when I traveled to Germany, one of the things that was so impressive to me was they actually admitted they were wrong, you know, with World War II and even World War I, and they wear their mistakes on their shirt sleeve. They're apologizing. They're saying how horrible it was and they will never do it again. We need to do the same. We plate and, you know, confront the atrocities that we did as white men and women coming over and make it right somehow. I don't know how the reparations will do it. I know there is a map, a reparation map that I posted on my website. You know, it's just interesting to look at and to try to wrap our heads around how we can make good and even the playing field. I mean, there's just, you know, hundreds of years of white supremacy, and we need to even the playing field. So I know people of color welcome all white people to join the movement and help put power behind this movement so that we can make it right. So that's it for that. I do want to share with you my weekly recipe. This is one of the appetizer recipes I shared on my Zoom class a few weeks ago. And, you know, during my radio show, I only have time to share one recipe at a time. But I didn't want to let this one go by because it is just such a great recipe, not only because it's so delicious, but it also helps people use parts of the vegetable that they otherwise so often traditionally just threw out or composted. So this uses radish greens, the tops of the radishes. You can also use the tops of beets. You can also use dandelion greens that you just find out in your yard while growing dandelion greens. But basically, you want to use, you know, very flavorful, somewhat bitter greens for this recipe, and it's just really delicious. And I learned how to make it through my dear sister-in-law, who's from the Republic of Georgia. And the key ingredient here is a mixed spice mix called Kamili Sunili, which is available online, and I have a link on my website to this spice. But this spice is a makeup of things like fenugreek and cardamom and I don't know what else, but it's just really great. And so I highly recommend getting this spice mix. So you're going to start with 2 cups of steamed radish greens, and it will take more than 4 cups to net 2 cups of steamed radish greens. It really, really shrinks down, as you know, when you steam greens. You can also use spinach or kale or, you know, any green for this, but the really wild, bitter greens are really delicious. So 2 cups of steamed radish greens, 1 cup of walnuts, 6 cloves of garlic, 1/2 cup of cilantro, and you really want to push the cilantro down, a full 1/2 cup pressed down into a measuring cup, 2 tablespoons of olive oil, 1/2 cup of red onion. If I don't have red onion, I use white onion, and that works fine too, 1 shallot chopped, 1 stalk of celery chopped, 1/2 teaspoon salt, 1/4 teaspoon pepper, 1 teaspoon to 2 teaspoons of the Kamili Sunili spice. And that, start with 1 teaspoon, and if you want, you can slowly add a little bit more. 1/2 teaspoon of cardamom, 1/2 teaspoon of cumin, and then 1/4 cup of olive oil. So you're going to first start with steaming the cups of the tops of the radish. And then you want to let it cool. You can just put it into an ice bath, which is really great because that just locks in the green color. And you don't want to oversteam it because you really want the bright green color. So put it into an ice bath. That's really great. And then squeeze out all of the water. Then you're going to saute the onions and the shallots in the 2 tablespoons of olive oil until they're translucent and golden brown. Add the chopped celery and continue cooking until the celery gets soft, about another 5 minutes. Using a food processor, you're going to pulse the radish tops until they're blended. You're going to add the garlic, the walnuts, and all the sautéed vegetables, the onions, the shallot, and the celery. Add the cilantro as well, and just going to keep pulsing that, scraping down the sides as you go so that you really pulse all of the greens and vegetables together until it's really fairly smooth. You can keep a little texture to it if you'd like, or you can make it fully smooth, whichever you want. And then after it's all pulsed together, you add the spices, the salt and pepper, pulse again, and then slowly through the opening in the top, you're going to slowly add the 1/4 cup of olive oil. And that's going to emulsify and make all the vegetables and the puree come together into a really nice paste. And that's going to be your pâté. And you can serve it with tortilla chips, pita chips, or crudités. And it's just so delicious. So enjoy it. I pretty much make that at every barbecue because I'm always harvesting radishes and beets from the garden. And so I'm just making it constantly all summer long, and I hope you do the same. And now it is my pleasure to introduce to all of you Stephanie Morningstar and Christine Hutchison from the Northeast Farmers of Color Land Trust. Stephanie and Christine, are you with me?
Hi, yeah. Hi, thanks for having us.
Sure, welcome to both of you. I hope you're enjoying this beautiful day here in New York. I thought I would first ask each of you to tell my listening audience a little bit about what you do and how you came to the Northeast Farmers of Color Land Trust, and then we'll actually talk about what the Northeast Farmers of Land Trust is. So, Stephanie, could you first introduce yourself to my listeners and tell them a little bit more about you? I know you're from the Oneida tribe and in your background. So, yeah, please share.
Hi, Sego, Sewa, Gwego, everybody. My name's Stephanie Morningstar, and I'm from the Oneida Nation, as you mentioned, Turtle Clan. I'm calling to you today from my homelands of Dish With One Spoon Treaty, which is the Western New York area. And, yeah, I came to the Northeast Farmers of Color Land Trust after working in a long string of positions that really kind of advanced justice in their own way. And, you know, working in the healthcare system, working in the legal system, and then eventually working with climate change research, where I really came to understand really deeply the need for land access and just to see the climate change, just the issues looming over us with climate change and the imminent crisis that we're already experiencing with climate change, with especially within marginalized communities. Yeah, so I came to the Land Trust with a strong desire to get Black and brown folks back on the land, farming the land, so that we can have a chance at being healthy and whole as these issues are looming over us.
Absolutely. But you're also an herbalist and a soil and seed steward, correct?
I am. I'm an herbalist. My practice is called Sky World Apothecary, which is based on my Haudenosaunee lineage and my Haudenosaunee cosmology. And I am a soil and seed steward. You're right. I'm a small-scale farmer. I farm primarily herbs and then food to feed my family here on the land that we rent. And, yeah, I have six cats and two dogs and a lovely partner in life whose name is Noel. And I'm just really honored to be here. I'm honored to work with Christine. I'm excited to talk with you and with Christine about the work that we're doing. And yeah, I'm just excited to be advancing the liberation of land and people.
Wonderful. Well, I'm really glad you are as well. And Christine, you have quite a resume as well. You want to share all the different projects and things that you have done so far in your amazing life?
Sure. I come to this out of a marriage of things that I love and care about. I'm coming from the education system, and I'm there entirely because I love kids, I love teens, and working with them and building them up. And I also love growing food. And until recently, I thought I just loved food, which I do, but it's also a matter of wanting to kind of have some say-so in what I eat and wanting other people to have say-so as well. And I've married those two loves through an organization that I run called Our Core. I work with teenagers in agriculture. We have an urban agriculture internship, and we have a course in the high school where I teach. And we've started working with these kids to get them in touch with land, help them learn about how food grows and what it's like to pick something and eat it. And simplest act of even planting seeds and watching them grow, we take them from that very beginning stage and start to educate them and allow for these experiences in agriculture with the hope that some of them will become land stewards in some way, shape, or form and possibly enter agriculture as an entrepreneur, start a farm or grow food.
And you also work as the education coordinator at Downing Park Urban Farm, right? Which is a community farm
in
upstate New York, right?
Yep. Yeah. That's where the kids do their internship. And what I found after getting them started on this path is that there really is no next place for them to go. What happens to them after they finish this internship? Where can they go to farm? And that brought me to this land access issue. And that kind of spurred my involvement with Northeast Farmers of Color. I want to make sure that not only do these Black and brown children get training in farming, but they have a place to do it.
So can one of you or both of you tell me and listeners what the Northeast Farmers of Color Land Trust does. I mean, I know what Land Trust does, and I assume most of my followers know as well. But maybe you can talk a little bit more directly about the Northeast Farmers of Color Land Trust.
Sure. So the Northeast Farmers of Color Land Trust came out of the network, which we call NEFOX. The network was established just to serve as a way of connecting Black and brown farmers to one another. And then the idea came about that after conversations and realizing that land access was this major issue, the idea of the land trust came about. So the network itself predates the land trust by a couple of years, and the land trust was established in 2019. And we've been working to build the structure of it so that it can serve to hold land and advance land sovereignty for these same farmers and land keepers who are involved in the NEFOX network. We have a set of principles that guide us in how we work on the land and use the land and appreciate the land and try to sustain and regenerate the land as well. And that's the beginning of this land trust.
Mm-hmm. So I didn't realize you were so new. You just started last year.
Yes. We're still a baby.
You are still a baby. Well, you've done a lot in your little baby year to spread the word and to get known. So that's wonderful. So what, maybe for Stephanie first, what first drew you to farming and land and the food sovereignty work that you're doing?
I would say this is something that's been really a life's passion for me. I started out, living in the suburbs. My family was forcibly relocated a while ago. My grandfather was a residential school survivor and moved across the border in the mid to late 40s with my first uncle, my oldest uncle, and my grandmother to escape the 60s scoop, which was an abduction program, basically, for Indigenous children in Canada, where folks were basically the child welfare system was abducting children and then adopting them out to all over the world, basically. My grandfather left the area to be able to sort of evade that and move to Buffalo, New York. And they lived right in the middle of the city in Buffalo, on the east side of Buffalo, for anybody listening from Sherman Street. They were very, very, very poor. And part of their way of feeding their family was by basically just informally farming and gardening on a piece of land in Irving, New York, about an hour's drive south of Buffalo and or southwest of Buffalo. I was actually just talking with my auntie about that, and she told me that she used to feel weird about eating the food that they used to grow because it was growing right in the dirt, and she just felt so strange about that. But I always had these connections to gardening and farming, and as I became more involved in herbal work, it really intersected with the social justice work that I was already active in, and realized that there are all these intersections, and one of the ways that we can maintain agency or step into agency as human beings is to grow our own food and grow our own medicines. So that's truly kind of where that started for me. About 10 years ago, I moved to Ontario, Canada, and moved back to my home reserve of Six Nations of the Grand River and worked with a traditional medicine healer and an Indigenous physician to open up a collaborative clinic called Jitta's Place, which is still in existence and they're still practicing. And that's really where a lot of these intersections came together between healing justice, land justice, food justice. It all kind of came on the heels of moving to Canada after the death of my mother. My mother was a really beautiful person, Oneida, just one of my best friends. And she had as I mentioned, there was this residential school there's a lot of intergenerational trauma around residential school survivors. And in my
family, can you explain what is a residential school survivor?
Yeah, a residential school in Canada, a residential school is a school where Indigenous children were kidnapped from their families and forced to be in a school off reserve, very close to, far away from their families. So, you know, instead of being right in the same town, they would ship children from their community, you know, 1,000 miles away to another community to keep them distanced from their family. It was an assimilation project that was enforced by the Indian Act in Canada. In the States, there's something similar called boarding schools, and this is where you would take Indigenous children and force assimilate them. So cut their hair, take them out of their traditional clothing, take their ability to speak their language away by force. And it was a mass assimilation project and a mass extermination project on many levels. Many, many children died or were abused, and it still is looming over us in a way that we're still trying to heal from.
Oh my God! I had no idea. Did our country do? Did the U.S. do that too?
Absolutely.
Yes. We had residential schools here in our country.
You have boarding schools in your country, yes.
No, I mean boarding schools where Indigenous children were forced to go.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, take a look.
It's amazing how, you know, history, depending on who you are or where you live, is taught differently. I mean, I was shocked, you know, that, a few months ago when there was the article in the New York Times about textbooks, you know, that, you know, the same textbooks with the same name and the same publisher and editor is different in Texas than it is in California. And states can choose which textbook they want to teach different histories. It's just unbelievable, and that this could have existed in our country, and, you know, in traditional U.S. education, we were not told about this, you know?
Why would you be?
Right.
Why would anybody want to, why would anybody in public education who's trying to mandate a specific set of, you know, norms and guidelines to live by, you know, talk about their dirty history? So, yeah, there are residential schools. The last one in Canada closed in 1996. Like, this isn't far, far, far in the past. And because of a lot of that work and because a lot of that trauma, there is a legacy of residential school syndrome now in the Indigenous people who are living today. And my mother was one of those people. And one of the ways that manifests is in something called white coat syndrome. And what that is it's a mistrust of, such a deep mistrust, embedded mistrust of the healthcare system that you basically refuse to go to the doctors and you have like physiological responses to that, like high blood pressure when you are presented with going to the doctors. And my mom had a history of this white coat syndrome and ended up in the emergency room with stage 4 ovarian cancer, thinking it was just like a pneumonia or something, and ended up dying a week later. And that was the day that I became activated in a lot of ways that I wasn't before, because I wanted to look into why that happened. It didn't make any sense to me. And it wasn't until I went and helped at the clinic back in 2011 that I started putting the pieces together, that I was seeing many patients coming in who were food insecure, who were afraid to engage the healthcare system, and seeing that all of these things are not separate from one another. They're all interconnected. And the legacy of colonization is something that we're still dealing with today, that adaptive monster that we call racism. If it can't enslave people, it will sharecrop. If it can't sharecrop, it will do heirs property to take land away. Like, it's basically just adapting to the current situation, which is why Nefolk Land Trust actually exists. We exist because so many of us have experienced the marginalization of colonization and extractive settler colonialism that we have started to call for reparations, and we've started to call for redistribution of wealth, which is all based on land.
Right, right. Wow. You know, it's like I have heard of this kind of residential school and these assimilation projects, you know, in Australia with Aboriginal children, and was horrified by it. But, you know, I never heard of it in Canada or here. You know, and I'm sure it happened in other places too. Like you said, it's just, you know, nobody wants to talk about it. And as I said in the beginning, I was so impressed, you know, when I went to Germany, how they were talking about it. You know, they were talking about their mistakes, maybe not some of the other ones, but at least as far as, you know, the Holocaust goes, I mean, they were certainly, you know, wearing their mistakes on their shirt sleeves so that it wouldn't happen again, in their hope, although we'll see what happens. Wow. Thank you so much for sharing that. And Christine, how did you come to the Northeast Farmers of Color Land Trust and the work you're doing?
I was part of the network, and initially we gathered to just build shares and have discussion, build community, and just have camaraderie. And as soon as I heard the first whispers of the idea, I realized that this was something I wanted to be a part of. And I have always looked at it from day one as potentially one of the greatest things that I could ever be a part of. So I jumped right in and offered myself up for the interim council. And that was the body that we initially established to kind of try and shape this thing. And once we were a little more fully formed and we were ready to have a board, I was nominated and happily was elected to the board. And I intend to remain a part of this organization, whether it's on the board or some other supporting role, permanently, to make sure that there are folks to help guide and support it, because I think this is truly an incredibly important organization.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And has the organization been successful so far in acquiring some land from government, or where do you get your land from?
We're open to accepting land from different sources, and as of right now, we don't entirely have the structural capacity to hold land, but there are offers on the table, so to speak, and from individuals who are ready to put into this work. So as soon as we are finished with our legal structure, we will begin taking in land, and I anticipate that a lot of people who want to put land into this land trust.
So, yeah, you really are in your beginning stages. Stephanie, you want to say something?
But there isn't.
Go ahead, Christine.
There is interest already. In New York State, I think there are 4 parcels that are potentially coming into land trust once we're ready.
And what is the acronym BIPOC?
Black, Indigenous, People of Color.
Okay. And Black, Indigenous, People of Color, Land Trust. So, and is that a separate organization, or that's part of the Northeast Farmers of Color Land Trust?
It's just terminology used to kind of cluster Black and brown folks. But it's not exclusive to NEFOC, and it's used elsewhere.
Right. Okay. And why? I mean, I think it's obvious, but why is it necessary to have a separate land trust for Black, Indigenous, People of Color?
This is necessary because most of the land in the United States is owned by white people. Black and brown people own about maybe 2% of the land in the United States, and in our region, the Northeast region covered by this land trust, almost 100% of the farmland is owned by white folks. Land access is the number one barrier to food sovereignty. When people want to farm and they don't have the space to farm, or they want to connect with their farmers who look like them and they don't exist, you can't have food sovereignty. In my own situation, I started to raise poultry small-scale commercial raising of poultry to sell to others. And even as a person who's employed outside of farming and earns a decent salary and can live, I was nowhere near able to afford to buy land in my area. And for a young person who's just coming up and just getting on his or her feet, it's an impossibility. I look at the programming I have for these young people, and I think of them in terms of what their next steps are. And it's not feasible for them to get a hold of land. There is no inherited land, and there's not a pool of funds to make purchase of land. So these people who don't have food sovereignty, who don't have access to grocery stores like they do in the suburbs, and who live in places where it's easier to get a fast food burger than it is to get a fresh head of lettuce, they don't have the sovereignty, and this land is the way to begin that. That is one of the first steps.
Yeah.
So it's
yeah.
absolutely necessary to have a land trust that prioritizes us.
So too, we're going to take a couple of minute break. When we come back, I want to hear from both of you how you go about acquiring that land. How does that happen? And how can my listeners and people who care about this get involved? So don't go anywhere. Everyone who's listening, if you just joined us, I'm talking with Stephanie Morningstar and Christine Hutchinson from the Northeast Farmers of Color Land Trust. We'll be right back.
You're tuned to PRN. We'll keep bringing you the best in alternative voices for social and political news, the environment, health, the economy, and a whole lot more. All you have to do is keep listening. PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
"5G is going to shut down our calcium channels. What are we going to be like without calcium channels?" Listen to PRN.FM, the Progressive Radio Network.
You are listening to PRN.FM, the Progressive Radio Network.
This is PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
PRN, the Progressive Radio Network, your home for progressive thinkers.
You're listening to PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Stay tuned to PRN.FM for more empowering ideas from progressive voices. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
This is Karen Hartglass, host of It's All About Food, and you're listening to PRN, your source for progressive, up-to-date, and inspirational information on nutrition and health.
Stay up to date with PRN for the latest on the coronavirus. Learn ways to stay spiritually vibrant and physically strong on PRN.FM, the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Stephanie Morningstar and Christine Hutchinson from the Northeast Farmers of Color Land Trust. And right before the break, I was asking them how the Land Trust goes about actually acquiring land. So can one of you fill us in on how a Land Trust goes about actually acquiring land?
Sure. So just to, as an FYI, or just to sort of reiterate, that the New Folk Land Trust is very new, and it takes a long time to become a land trust. It isn't something that you sort of open your doors and the next month you're acquiring land. Building a land trust is something that is legally very, it's like a heavy lift, and especially when you're doing something as large in scale as the Northeast region of the United States, that's, many municipalities, many states, many different legal structures. So what I would say right now is that, we do have some land donations that are pledged. We have about 200 acres currently pledged that will be going through the acquisitions process. And that takes quite a while. It's a lot of legalese that we don't really necessarily need to get into, but the way that we are acquiring land mainly is through land-based wealth redistribution. What that is it's a recognition that the generational wealth that people of privilege hold is based on land. That generational wealth was built on the stolen land and the stolen labor of Indigenous and Black folks. So when we're looking at a way to repair that harm, as you had mentioned earlier, what we're doing is we're doing that through something called reparations, and we're doing that through things like rematriation of land. What that means is that as people are becoming more aware of the land trust and our message, and that's basically what we've been doing is going around and sharing who we are, why a BIPOC-specific land trust is necessary right now, and then some of our strategies to make sure that the land that we are acquiring is being acquired in a way that's coming under our care in a way that isn't replicating that same colonial harm of that theft of labor and land. So we're doing things like reparations, which is you have a reparations map. It's a peer-to-peer map that I believe you shared on your website that is folks who are Black and brown folks with land-based projects can put their project on the map, and folks are looking at that map and reaching out directly to those farmers of color across, actually it's the map is across the entire U.S. and Canada. They can do that directly, or they can reach out to the land trust or to me or to our email address and just get in touch and let us know that they have land that they potentially want to donate. Before we can do anything with that land, we have to remember and recognize that 1.5 billion acres of land were stolen between the years of 1787 and 1876 from Indigenous people. And that's not including the original 13 colonies, most of which the Northeast is included in, which was never in, never had a treaty or association on that land. Most of the land in the Northeast is unceded territory. What that means is there's no treaty on that land. It was never formally signed over or relinquished. It was truly stolen. One of the things that we need to do as a land trust in order to honor the original vision that our fiscal sponsor, Soulfire Farm, laid out, and the original founders of the idea of the land trust laid out, was to uplift and center Indigenous sovereignty and share sovereignty through accountability mechanisms. The way that we're manifesting those accountability mechanisms to the original peoples of the Northeast is through something called our Indigenous Consultation Protocol. So every piece of land that comes through our doors and for to steward would be then going through this process of Indigenous consultation. It's something that really sets us apart from a lot of other land trusts. I know there are some out there who are starting to entertain this in the Northeast and other places, but what that means is that we're engaging the voices in this, in the leadership of these Indigenous nations across the Northeast to just say, we exist, this is what we're doing, we're trying to build sovereignty, we want to do this in alliance with you, we want to know how do we help you, how do we honor your sovereignty on these stolen lands, and how do we mutually work together to build food sovereignty. So it's a bit of a process legally, but truly it's about relationship building. It's about connecting with us as a land trust. And even though this is something that is a transaction, it means so much more than that. When you become a land donor or a private donor financially of the Nefolk Land Trust, you become a part of our family. And there's a whole sort of relationship that unfolds as we're working together to ensure that we're acquiring land in an ethical and meaningful manner.
Mm-hmm. Right. How much land is
still not owned by anybody? Like, how much land is out there that does not have an ownership in the Northeast region? That is, you know, I guess governments own it since no one else owns it. How does that work, and how much land is there, and do local governments have the power to donate that land?
We actually don't know. We're doing an environmental scan of that very question. It's kind of an interesting question because truly we don't believe anybody can own land. We feel like that would be owning a person. But that's sort of a difference in worldview, I think, between the sort of indigenous worldview and the Western worldview, is that we do see land, we see water, we see food, we see creation or nature as a being. And it just seems kind of strange that you can own a being. So what we say is you can own rights to be on that piece of land, but we don't necessarily own the land themselves. I did hear of a piece of land in Neetmuck territory, which is in Massachusetts, that just a small parcel of land that doesn't have any title on it. And I know that they're working to do something with that land that would keep it sovereign, really sovereign unto itself. That's truly what that means. And sovereign land is very hard to find at this point. But our goal is to be able to free land from that, the shackles of being owned, quote unquote, and returning it to sovereignty in some ways. I don't know if that's possible necessarily within the current system, but we don't actually have the number offhand of what that might look like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it just seems like as more people become aware of this need and of reparations and how to try to give back, especially white people of, you know, that have the power in government, need to get on board with that. And you know, in our world, it is kind of like, whether it, I guess when you give it to a land trust, that is kind of keeping it sovereign. No one has to own it, but then you can lease it or lend it out to different people to work it. But
right.
Yeah, I'd be very curious to know how much there is, and basically whatever is not owned by somebody at this point, I feel like should be donated to, you know, indigenous and people of color, because, as you said, you know, all those 1.5 billion acres, basically the whole country, was stolen. So,
there is land that is owned by folks who have generational wealth, meaning they inherited their land from generation to generation. That land also is something that we are looking for. We are looking not just for what's left over, but we're looking for resituating ourselves on the land in a way that folks are actually doing that. They're rematriating land to indigenous nations that their families have inherited. They're giving land and returning land to black farmers that their families may have inherited or scooped up through something like heirs property. The thing that I'm noticing also is that we're working right now with American Farmland Trust on something called the Faithlands Return Toolkit.
Can you say that again? The what?
It's called the Faithlands Return Toolkit. And what that is it's working with faith-based organizations, so different churches, to recognize complicity in things like the doctrine of discovery. So things that really, you know, establish the taking of land and the colonization of the Northeast and many other of the U.S. and many other places on Earth through those papal bulls, those original papal bulls that the doctrine of discovery comes from. So basically the taking of land and the creation or recognition of something called, quote unquote, terra nullius or empty land when, you know, we have been here since time immemorial. So there's this idea that working with churches and working with faith-based organizations to recognize that they're working on the land that they've acquired and through the missionization and coming to the U.S. or coming to the Northeast, that's something that we're trying to get folks to recognize, that there could be land returned from churches. There's also expropriated land through universities, and one of those universities that has taken and amassed many pieces of land in the Northeast is Cornell University. So getting to recognizing that there is land that's being held that was stolen from Indigenous and Black folks for a long, long time, and we're calling for the return of that land as well. We don't really just want like whatever is left over or whatever is still sovereign. We're looking for folks to actively donate the land they inherited through their own generational wealth that was built on the land and labor of Indigenous and Black folks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense for those that have had it. Because, you know, as you read about the as you read more about Black Lives Matter, and, you know, I'm right now reading the book, How to Be an Anti-Racist, you know, as white people educate themselves more about the systemic racism that is built into our country and our world and our policies, you know, I hope, can start to understand the depths of how deep this goes and how long it's been going on and how, you know, how hard it is to try to make up for generations and generations of wealth that's been passed on. I mean, so many people that are quote unquote successful today are successful because of all of the wealth that's been passed on from generation to generation. And how do you make up for that? And how do you, you know, give back to, you know, and try to even the playing field? I mean, it's just, it's really mind-boggling to try to figure out. And I salute you guys and thank you so much for doing the hard work, because it's not easy, you know, while, of course, supporting yourselves and growing good food and making everything else, you know, doing all the other good work you're doing. So I salute you both. So how has the COVID situation affected your work? Hello?
Christine?
I'm sorry, I had to unmute. So the COVID situation has really shown some things that were under the surface and not really seen before. The systemic racism that exists, the health detriments that Black and brown people are facing, the fact that they don't have agency as much, or we don't have agency as much in our employment, and we're more highly exposed. These things are all kind of coming forth as the curtain is pulled back, so to speak. We have a huge disparity in the number of deaths, even though Black people are 13% of the population, we're 34% of the COVID deaths. We are more often employed in the so-called essential industries or essential services to a greater degree than white people, so we're more exposed to this virus. So it's impacting us in those ways as well as in food access ways. We are coming unemployed and already don't have a lot of financial stability, so being able to access quality food comes up again and a lack of ability to afford it. And in terms of the work in farming, right now what we are doing is trying to produce more food to serve our community and kind of fill that gap. So it makes the work of growing quality food and getting this food out to our folks even more imperative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think you're right as far as, you know, it's out there for everybody to see how this pandemic has been affecting people of color and marginalized communities so much more than white communities. And it's just, you know, it's just horrible. I mean, our healthcare system is horrible. You know, I mean, I always say if our government was paying for our healthcare, if we had universal healthcare, it would be in their interest to have us all be healthy and eating healthy food. And, you know, everything is just so connected. And everyone's in cahoots with everyone, and it's all about money, and it's all about marketing, and it's just one big mess. And slowly, as we pick it apart and dismantle it, we can try to address the whole of it. I mean, we have to address the parts, but we have to look at the whole. And I think that's one of the things that so often in this country we don't do. We try to just fix one little part, but you can't just fix one little part without looking at the whole thing. And that's why I think, the momentum that the Black Lives Movement has gotten, which, needs to not only be Black Lives Movement, but people of color, indigenous people, all marginalized people, immigrants, the whole gamut, has to be really looked at and worked as a whole problem, and not just dissected piece by piece. And so I think systemic racism is really the root cause of all these problems, so many of these problems, and money and poverty. And so anyway, I just want to thank you both so much for joining us. We're just about out of time. I will share the links to all of your website and to your contact information on my website. You want to just share the Land Trust email or website so people can find out more?
Yeah, the Land Trust website is nefolklandtrust.org, and that's N as in Nancy, E, F as in Frank, O, C, landtrust.org, and the email to reach us is connect@nefolklandtrust.org. I appreciate you having us on today.
Thank you so much for joining me. Thank you for your work. It's really awesome, and I wish the Land Trust such good good hopes, and I really hope a lot of land gets acquired by you guys or shared by you guys and helps move this process forward. So thank you both for joining me. And everyone out there listening, thank you for listening and joining us, and I wish you all a beautiful holiday weekend, and I'll see you all again next week. Bye for now.